This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Last night was a big one for Wisconsin Republicans at the GOP convention in Cleveland. Both U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and House Speaker Paul Ryan gave speeches. Tonight, Governor Scott Walker is scheduled to speak.
WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is in Cleveland. He's with us now for the latest from the convention. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Well, a couple big names from Wisconsin speaking last night. Senator Johnson, as we mentioned, House Speaker Paul Ryan. What stood out to you from what they had to say?
So I think if this were a normal year, you might listen to both those speeches and say really nothing. I mean, there was nothing that really jumped out at you, but this is not a normal year, of course. This has been a year in which those two gentlemen, Ron Johnson and House Speaker Paul Ryan, have been sort of unsure how they wanted to handle the party's nominee, Donald Trump. But last night, they decided to kind of go all in on Trump. And here's a little sample of that. First, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and House Speaker Paul Ryan.
Donald Trump and Mike Pence understand that these must be America's top priorities. They'll be strong leaders.
None of this will happen under Hillary Clinton. Only with Donald Trump and Mike Pence do we have a chance at a better way.
So both of them, Sean, addressing their legislative priorities, things that Republicans would want to accomplish in Congress. They can only do it with a Republican president, they're saying. So they're not making the case, it sounds like, that Donald Trump is a great president. They're saying, hey, we need him if we're going to pass our stuff.
Exactly. So they've moved past the stage of only criticizing Hillary Clinton to now moving toward Donald Trump. Although, as you heard in those two little clips there, it seems like having Mike Pence on that ticket and being able to say Donald Trump and Mike Pence has made it a little bit more palatable for them, a little easier for them. He often gets mentioned in the same breath as Donald Trump.
Now, this is a Wisconsin Republican Party that was not on board with Donald Trump particularly. They gave him his last obstacle voting for Ted Cruz in the primaries. Do you see Mike Pence as sort of the bridge between those primaries and the general election? Like, this is how we Wisconsin Republicans get to supporting Trump?
It seems like it. And also, I mean, Mike Pence has something in common with the people who are speaking here. I mean, he has been elected before. He's been in the political arena. And so, I mean, Donald Trump's entire pitch to voters is trashing politicians, right? And so it's sometimes hard for people, you know, who have butted heads with him in that political arena to say nice things about him. Mike Pence is a little different. He is a governor from a Midwestern state. He has kind of the same traditional conservative backers that conservatives in Wisconsin have. And so he's definitely a bridge for them.
The build theme of last night's speeches was supposed to be economy, job issues, things like that. Was there a consistent focus on that?
Not even close, no. I mean, it was plastered across all the screens in the room. I think it was make America work again. Especially in Ron Johnson's speech, the economy wasn't really even brought up. He started out his remarks alluding to an exchange that he had with Secretary Clinton, a contentious exchange over Benghazi. Went on to talk about a number of other terrorist threats, said that Clinton didn't take seriously, quote, radical Islamic terror. And his entire speech was foreign policy based. And he lumped Russ Feingold, his Democratic opponent, former senator, who he unseated in 2010, lumped Feingold together with Secretary Clinton on all these, and then also criticized Feingold for voting against the Patriot Act when he was in the Senate.
We've seen a lot of mentions of Hillary Clinton in the speeches last night. How much did Paul Ryan and Ron Johnson talk about Donald Trump in their speeches?
Yeah, so Trump gets just, he got a couple mentions from Paul Ryan, got a couple mentions from Ron Johnson. Hillary Clinton is still really the unifying glue that seems to be bringing Republicans together at this convention. That being their dislike of her and their dread of her becoming president. So in all these speeches, you're hearing them mentioning Hillary Clinton. We can't have her be president. We don't trust her. She can't nominate our Supreme Court justices. And then Ron Johnson and Paul Ryan's speeches were actually pretty tame compared to, say, Chris Christie's when the crowd was shouting to lock her up, referring to Secretary Clinton. So that got pretty heated there.
We're talking to WPR's Sean Johnson. He is at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Let's take things to breakfast this morning, Sean. I guess the Wisconsin delegation is having breakfast together. Senator Johnson spoke again there this morning. What was he focusing on over eggs and bacon?
Yeah, it was kind of an impromptu speech for Senator Johnson. But he, you know, is noteworthy. He's not reading from the teleprompter there. This was not prepared remarks as far as you could see. And he still came out and said, we have to deliver Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes to Donald Trump, that the consequences are too great. Another noteworthy speaker at this breakfast, unplanned, Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, the dean of Wisconsin's congressional delegation, who told Republicans there he reads a lot of polls, does a lot of retail politics, and he's pretty troubled by what he's seeing in Wisconsin right now, especially in the Marquette surveys that have shown that since Donald Trump got in the race, but was effectively locked up the nomination earlier this year, the percentage of likely Republican voters in Wisconsin has really plummeted. He says if that continues, they're going to lose this November.
And are they worried not just about those electoral votes for president, but also you mentioned Senator Johnson's rematch against Russ Feingold?
Yeah, I would say they're probably as worried, if not more worried, about Johnson's race. And not only that, I mean, if that many Republicans stay home, that's just going to have effects on down the ticket from races for Congress, perhaps in the 8th congressional district where Republicans currently hold that seat, but it's a competitive seat, has a potential to flip, and then on down into races for the state legislature. If turnout is drastically lower for Republicans, that is going to hurt them even more in a presidential year when turnout is higher for Democrats.
Well, the Wisconsin just keeps on coming, it looks like. Governor Scott Walker, as I understand it, scheduled to speak tonight. Do we know anything about what is on his agenda?
Yeah, he says he's going to, you know, explicitly endorse Donald Trump. And so that's going to maybe be a little out of place tonight, because following him on the agenda is Ted Cruz. And there's reports back and forth that Cruz may not actually do that he's not quite there. And so to hear Scott Walker, somebody who's been critical of the Donald Trump, who ran against him last year, get up on stage and say, I support him now in clear terms, that's noteworthy. Although Scott Walker's not the headliner tonight, you've got, in addition to Cruz, you've got Marco Rubio, and then you've got Mike Pence, Trump's vice presidential nominee, who's going to give his big speech tonight.
And the hope, I guess, there for the Trump campaign and for party leadership is that these former competitors with Donald Trump will give a unifying message. Is there hope that that's going to bring people together, maybe get those last holdouts on board?
I mean, that's the hope, but not everybody's there yet. I mean, John Kasich's been a little bit uneasy about throwing his support behind Trump. Jeb Bush is not going to do it. And even if they do, they're deep in the thick of politics, right? Voters who supported them may not be ready to make that jump. And you look in Southeast Wisconsin in particular, one of the Republican powerhouses of America, and there are a lot of Republican voters there who aren't going to, they're not quite ready to make that jump to Donald Trump yet. So it's a problem for Republicans right now. They're trying to rectify it, but this convention kind of highlights that they still have issues.
Sean, before we let you go, just big picture, there are worries about confrontations between protesters and supporters and police. There was that Donnybrook over the rules vote, the voice vote the other day. What's the tone been just in the last 24 hours or so? Calm, crazy, what?
So it hasn't been the chaotic type of convention, I think, that a lot of people were expecting, aside from that first day when they had the argument, the shouting match over the rules. A lot of times the convention floor is half empty, even during the speeches at night. The place empties out. So not only is it not chaotic, it gets kind of quiet in there, actually. Out in the streets, you know, I've seen, you were in Wisconsin, so we've seen some pretty big crowds of protesters there. I've seen nothing like that in the streets of Cleveland. A lot of small crowds of protesters, a huge police presence, though. And it's really hard to get around in Cleveland because there's security barriers up all over the place.
Sean, thanks for bringing us up to date.
You're welcome, Rob.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, reporting from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. He's with us on Central Time every day this week to share the latest news from there.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is bracing itself for a heat wave expected to hit tomorrow. Our guest tells us what to expect and what's causing the extreme weather.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Politicians do many things to show they are one of us, visiting diners, kissing babies, eating whatever on a stick at the state fair. It's a story with a long history. Eric Dregney tells us about the importance of fishing to political aspirations.
In this wild political season, no one has asked the important question, which presidential candidate can catch fish? In the past, politicians desperate to appear as one of the people seemed to believe that nothing did this better than sitting in a boat. President Herbert Hoover wrote, "All men are equal before fish," and that no political aspirant can qualify for election unless he demonstrates he is a fisherman. Fishing reduces the ego in presidents and former presidents, he said, for at fishing, most men are not equal to boys. Either that, or they try to show how heroic they are. President Hoover poked fun at these amateurs acting as sportsmen just to get votes. He mocked presidential candidate Calvin Coolidge when he fished for trout with worms on the Brule River in northern Wisconsin. Hoover remembered 10 million fly fishermen at once evidenced disturbed minds. The most famous, inexplicable presidential fishing trip was surely Jimmy Carter's bizarre story. In the summer of 1979, his small boat was attacked by a rabbit while he fished in Georgia. The Washington Post ran the story on its front page the following day about a bonsai bunny on the fishing trip, exaggerating that the aquatic attack rabbit was hissing menacingly, its teeth flashing and nostrils flared and making straight for the president. To Carter's credit, he insisted that the story was true, even if politically he would have been wiser to have never mentioned this curious event. While fish may not be political, fishing definitely is. Or at least politicians try to make it an issue. In the 1890s, Wisconsin Governor George Peck wrote a mock editorial in the Milwaukee Sun about a fish that should become the state symbol. "The bullhead never went back on a friend," he wrote. "It is a fish that is a friend of the poor and one that will sacrifice itself in the interest of humanity. That is the fish that the state should adopt as its trademark and cultivate friendly relations with and stand by. We allude to the bullhead." Although Peck did think that this lowly fish was perhaps much more noble than the aristocratic whitefish, his satirical plea fell on deaf ears. The bullhead was not loved. Instead, the muskie became the state fish, immortalized with a 145-foot-long, four-stories-tall fish in Hayward at the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame. If a candidate for office didn't want to let a day slip away in the boat, he or she could stop for a photo op in front of the giant fish. The museum's director, Emmett Brown, told me that the fish statue is really more or less a way to push tourism up here in Hayward. "We've grown far beyond that and have become a regular stopping ground for the governors of Wisconsin." Sure, but can you believe them when they say that they caught the big one?
Eric Dregney is the author of many books, including his most recent, Let's Go Fishing, Fish Tales from the North Woods. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, the National Weather Service has issued an excessive heat watch for the southern half of Wisconsin starting tomorrow, with a heat index in the hundreds and up. The heat is expected to be dangerous, especially for the elderly and people without air conditioning.
The question on most people's minds, probably, when is it going to end?
Michael Morgan is here to help us get a handle on what's going on with the heat and when it's expected to hit. Michael is a UW-Madison Atmospheric Sciences professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, so Michael, first of all, when is the leading edge of this heat wave supposed to get to us?
Well, you know, looking, the leading edge of this heat wave is probably going to arrive sometime late tomorrow morning, early afternoon. And as you mentioned, the Weather Service has issued an excessive heat watch as well as an excessive heat warning for a period extending from about noon tomorrow through 7 p.m. on Friday.
I know what watches and warnings mean for tornadoes. What does it mean when we're talking about heat?
Well, for heat, the watch is typically put into place when there is the expectation a few days out of an extended period in which what's called a heat index, which is sort of a combination of heat and humidity, makes temperatures feel like they'll be excessively warm. In this case, 100 to maybe 110 degrees Fahrenheit in terms of what you actually feel, what it feels like. And a warning's in place when they are pretty sure it's going to happen.
All right, so you're saying some parts of the states have a warning right now and some parts of the state may move to a warning.
Maybe they're on a watch and will move to a warning.
Right.
It's kind of interesting that the Weather Service actually for our area has both in effect at the same time. Maybe they're about to drop one of them and keep the other. I'm not certain about that. Earlier today it was just a heat warning. Now it's a heat warning and a heat watch. So there is a little bit of uncertainty, actually, as to how long this period of extreme, excessive warmth is going to last. The Weather Service, again, is thinking about around noon tomorrow through 7 p.m. on Friday. But I think the issue is, for Friday, will it last that long or not? And so that just to be cautious, I think they have the watch out. But I think for tomorrow, they're pretty certain it's going to be pretty uncomfortable and sort of dangerous for the health, uncomfortable in terms of the heat and humidity tomorrow.
So which parts of the states are the most likely to see this heat?
I think it's going to be basically southern Wisconsin, south-central Wisconsin, southwestern Wisconsin, and western parts of the state. As you move to the northeastern part of the state, they are going to be rather warm. But in terms of having a heat watch or heat excessive heat watch or heat warning, in effect, that's not the case right now. If you look actually to the northeastern part of the state from north of Beaver Dam and northeast of Wisconsin Dells, they're under a heat advisory. So they're expecting a few hours period of time tomorrow for temperatures to get the heat index to be above 100 degrees or so. But it's really the southwestern and southern parts of the state that are really under the gun for a potential for this excessive heat warning, where temperatures could go well in excess of 100 degrees. Heat indices could go well in excess of 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
So what's to blame for this heat? I mean, I know that it's a complicated answer. I feel like usually when we see unusual conditions, we look to El Nino or La Nina, but
right.
But what do we know this time?
Well, for this time, I mean, part of it is in the last several weeks, maybe the last month or so, it's been a slightly drier than normal. So we have drier soils. And so what happens just on a typical day is when the sun comes up, the sun heats the ground gets warmer, and then you get mixing that distributes the heat over a good portion of the lower part of the atmosphere. What's interesting is, and when the soil is wet, when the ground is wet, some of that radiation from the sun also helps to evaporate the water from the ground, and then it goes into heating the ground. And so because we've had slightly drier conditions, a lot of the solar radiation is going directly to heating the ground, which ultimately will heat the air above the ground. And so the dryness that we've had is going to exacerbate the problem. But another issue is not so much the soil temperatures here, but if you look back over parts of Iowa and southwest of us and south of us, there's a lot of corn, a lot of irrigation of crops, and also some slightly wetter soil conditions. And some of that moisture is being transported northward, and that's helping to increase our humidities, our dew points in particular. And so when you have the extreme heat, just because we've been relatively dry and we're having that heat transported over us, and you have the effects of higher water vapor content in the air, the higher dew points, which will help raise our relative humidity somewhat. Those two combined give us these excessive, the conditions for an excessive heat warning.
Now, you mentioned the corn, and I've heard anecdotally that the corn is responsible for the humidity that we get here in Wisconsin and maybe the allergies, too. Is that true?
Yeah, for the humidity, particularly if you look at, just looking at a map, I was looking at a map just a few moments ago before we went on the air, and you look at parts, areas over Iowa, then also if you even go back to the northern plains, there are places there that have dew points, and this is due to irrigation. So you can basically look at it as you water the corn. Corn is a very water-intensive crop. It tastes good to eat, but it's also very water-intensive. And so one of the issues is as you water those plants for them to grow and to be healthy, the roots of the corn take up that water from the soil that goes into the corn, and the corn through the leaves, a lot of the water vapor just gets released from the leaves, and this is what's called evapotranspiration. So the corn basically acts as a wick to take moisture from the soil and transport it into the air. that air, now more moist, can get transported elsewhere, northward from the corn-growing belts of Iowa and northern Illinois into southern Wisconsin. The corn that's growing in our neighborhood, you know, in our region here, also is contributing to some of the water, the higher water vapor content of the air. But more broadly, we have the Gulf of Mexico well to our south and other areas and other types of crops that are growing that are irrigated, and that moisture ultimately can be transported northward. Sometimes it doesn't make it all the way here because it gets erupted up into thunderstorms. But yes, agriculture broadly can exacerbate the conditions that we're going to be experiencing.
And Michael, I know safety might not be your specialty, but generally any ideas for keeping safe during this heat, which is forecast to be possibly dangerous?
Right. The Weather Service is definitely highlighting this as a reason they have these watches and warnings in place is because it can really affect people that have, that are elderly in particular. So you want to basically, they urge people to check on relatives, neighbors. Yes, if you can stay in air-conditioned places, do that. If you know people that don't have air conditioning, maybe invite them into your home or just check on them. The big thing is to stay hydrated, drink plenty of fluids so that your body temperature doesn't get extremely high. It's these conditions, because it's so humid, our body already has a natural way for us to cool off, and that's through just perspiration, sweating. And that sweat, as it evaporates, helps to cool our skin. But when the air is so humid and our body's trying to cool off, the perspiration, the evaporation process is compromised. It's weaker because it's less effective, and so our bodies can feel much warmer, and that can lead to serious illnesses. So trying not to overexert yourself in the heat, doing what you have to do early in the morning or in the evening after sunset, wearing light clothing, loose-fitting clothing, and drinking lots of water are some of the best things to do under conditions like this.
All right, and it all ends, well, at least we get some relief on Friday, right, Michael?
Yeah, late on Friday and over the weekend, and then by the time we get to Monday and Tuesday, it looks like a slight break in the pattern. And if I dare look at forecast models for even a week or two out, it looks even better. So just keep your fingers crossed on that. And again, this is the peak season for the peak time of the year for us to get some of our warmest temperatures. We're going to be well above normal the next couple of days, but we're going to see a trend back to some closer to normal by early next week.
Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Michael Morgan, UW-Madison Atmospheric Sciences Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, joining us to talk about the expected heat wave coming tomorrow.
Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, NPR continues its ongoing coverage of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. That starts tonight at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, if you have a chronic disease, you probably spend a lot of time dealing with the healthcare system. According to the National Health Council, chronic diseases affect more than 40% of the population. About half of all adults have a chronic condition, and almost a third of the population is now living with multiple chronic conditions.
All that adds up to a lot of time dealing with the healthcare system, whether it's making appointments with specialists, following up on treatments, maybe filling multiple prescriptions every month, or coordinating with labs to get test results.
We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What's your experience like dealing with the healthcare system? Does it ultimately feel like a lot of work coordinating care for yourself or your kid or maybe an aging loved one? Do you feel like there could be changes, things that could make the healthcare system in the U.S. work better for you, or a consumer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dr. Victor Montori joins us now. He's a professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic. He's a practicing diabetes doctor, researcher, an author, and a recognized expert in minimally disruptive medicine. Dr. Montori, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
You talk about the work of being a patient. What do you mean by that?
Well, I refer to perhaps one of those major blind spots in medicine. If you were to look at any textbook of medicine, go to any medical school and look at their curriculum, it doesn't exist. There is no study, understanding, measurement, or consideration of how much work, effort, attention, and time patients and their families have to put in the process of accessing care, using the care that they need to use, and establishing the self-care practices that are necessary to manage any chronic condition. As a result, it's an important part of care, but it's widely ignored.
Now, you're a practicing physician. Can you give us an example of what somebody might go through?
Absolutely. I work in Minnesota, and very similar to some of my colleagues in Wisconsin, we see, for instance, farmers. For farmers, the harvest is an important part of the year, and their focus is on making sure that the harvest goes as planned. If you have a chronic condition that requires attention, such as diabetes, a clinician wouldn't be surprised if the patient may not be able to handle both the harvest and their care for diabetes at the same time. And it is often the case that when I see patients during the harvest that their sugar control is just not as good as some other time of the year. Well, the temptation for a physician may be to intensify the treatment. In other words, ask the patient to do more work to get their diabetes control be better during the harvest, without recognizing that what's happening is we are competing in healthcare with patient work. We're competing with the farming work, and of course, the sustainability of the patient's family and their financial well-being for the rest of the year depends on the harvest work. So that's an example of where when we take care of people, we will ignore the fact that what we ask people to do is work, and that it competes with the same energy, attention, and time that people will have for other things that are more meaningful in their lives.
You were quoted in an article about this in the publication Vox.com, and the writer there was going through something similar to what you described. She wasn't a farmer. She was a runner, and she had a full-time job as well. And she said she viewed all the time and the hours that she had to put into her healthcare as kind of a really badly paying part-time job. Do you think that's what it is for some patients?
I have to say that many of my patients, when I've used the term burden, that there is a burden of healthcare or a burden of treatment, they've rejected that term because they recognize that many of these tasks, they just have to do them to be well and to be alive. But when one looks carefully, one notices that the reason people have to wait and have to make calls and make sure that faxes are sent around and communication takes place and all this other work of coordinating care and getting the care that one needs, that is not because of, you know, a natural law or divine intervention. This is how healthcare has organized itself to be perhaps efficient in its own delivery of care, but in some ways becoming efficient by transferring work and effort to patients. If you have a simple condition, maybe you can deal with the inconvenience. But if you end up accumulating multiple chronic conditions and your care is complicated, these little inconveniences add up to what I think correctly the reporter called a part-time job.
We're talking right now to Dr. Victor Montori from the Mayo Clinic about the work involved with being a patient, coordinating your care, calling the pharmacy, making appointments, getting x-rays scheduled, and what all of that can take, the time involved, the labor, and what he calls the burden. And Dr. Montori, does it have to be that way? You say healthcare has organized itself that way. In some ways, there are efficiencies there, but is there a better way?
Yeah. We believe that healthcare can be minimally disruptive on patients, that the efforts of efficiency should not stop at the door of the hospital or at the door of the clinic. They should continue into the patient's workplace or into the patient's kitchen or bathroom, where the patient is organizing and the families are organizing how to take care of pills and coordinate appointments and these sorts of things. We need to make the whole process waste-free, and particularly for patients and their families, because they don't have the resources and personnel and support that the healthcare system have. They have to just do it on their own.
What part does the healthcare insurance industry play in all this?
They could be part of the solution. I believe they're not. The way healthcare is reimbursed, the way healthcare is paid, sometimes introduces unnecessary procedures, paperwork, that add to the work that the patient has to do to get the care they need. Sometimes they have to make additional phone calls in order to just organize some of the care that is necessary. There's effort now to force patients to shop around for maybe better prices for some services like, say, MRI scans. But that shopping around may actually find the patient having to go 90 miles to another facility to get their MRI just because it's less expensive for the insurer, for the payer. Without that, of course, it makes a lot of sense until you realize that it's very expensive, perhaps, for a busy single mother of two children to take the time away from their low-paying job and risk that job, perhaps, for getting to that cheaper MRI. So we need to. The payers have to understand that they can't make their model on the shoulder of patients.
And let's take a caller now. We've got Teresa on the line waiting to talk to you in Madison. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I am a RN case manager in Madison for one of the healthcare providers. I do help with care coordination. It's a free service we offer. We do look at prices. We do help in network and out-of-network care. We coordinate appointments, we do education, and we try to take some of the stress out of that situation for the family members. We have a long way to go, but we've been around for a while, and I think we're definitely part of the solution.
And Teresa, do people know about you, and how does someone access a service like that?
Well, I work for SSM, Dean, St. Mary's, and on our website, we usually have a case management section where you can do a self-referral, a doctor can refer. It depends on what your needs are. Can you hear me?
Uh-huh. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And so that is one way, and it is a free service. It's a part of their benefits. I wish we were better utilized, but I'm very proud of what I do. We have embedded case managers in the clinics, and then we have telephonic case managers, and then we have other nurses that do utilization review. So we're all working very hard to try to fix this problem. I know we have a long way to go, but it needs to be part of the solution.
Teresa, thank you so much for that. And Dr. Montori, what do you think about a solution like that, where there are individual systems set up within the healthcare system to organize patient care from the inside?
Yeah, of course, it's great work. And one of the things that is a challenge for care coordinators is what are their marching orders? And in many health systems, care coordinators are there to advocate for the patient and to facilitate things for the patient. But in other environments, care coordinators are there to make sure that patients do the work that they've been asked to do. And in those settings, those care coordinators tend to be quite frustrated, get quite frustrated because they know that they're asking people to do things that they have no capacity themselves to do. Care coordinators can be real heroes for patients if they're able to really act on their behalf, reduce the work of navigating the system on behalf of patients to achieve patient goals. But again, sometimes they're put in place to achieve the health system goals and to find ways of getting patients to do that work. It's interesting to me that the system recognizes that it's poorly designed and requires people to hire additional people to navigate the system rather than redesigning the system to make it easier for everyone. And I think that there is an opportunity for systems to look seriously at the way they've evolved and ask the question, why couldn't our services be so easy that we wouldn't need navigators to help patients find the care that they need?
We're talking to Dr. Victor Montori right now from the Mayo Clinic about the work involved with being a patient.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is it tough to navigate your work life and your health care needs? How would you like to see the healthcare system operate differently? What's your experience been like as a patient? Or if you're a provider, what's your experience? What are your insights? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation now with Dr. Victor Montori of the Mayo Clinic about the work of being a patient.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had this experience of being a patient, maybe having a chronic need, and it feels like a part-time job that you have to coordinate around your job, your family, people you're taking care of yourself? Do you agree that the healthcare system needs to do more to help patients? What do you think would make the healthcare system better in the United States, make it work more efficiently and maybe more conveniently for the patients? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Dr. Montori, before we get back to the callers, I want to ask you about some maybe alternatives. One of these that you've talked about is healthcare homes, and the other would be taking the care to the patient. So maybe there are physicians available in workplaces, in schools, in businesses, things like that. What about those options?
Yeah, I think they have to be organized carefully around the needs of the patients. I think that there are a number of things now, before we even change completely the models of care, there are a number of things that we could do to simplify things for folks. And those come usually from seriously considering whether everything that we're asking patients to do is necessary, and the mechanisms by which the ways in which we're asking them to do it. For instance, a patient with two or three chronic conditions probably is asked to come to clinic and have blood drawn, and they're probably being asked to check blood sugars or blood pressure values at home before they come in, and so forth. And the question that the clinician and patient should be asking is all this work really worth it? So we have to do it. And the answer, yes, you have to do it because this protocol is no longer acceptable. So I would say that before people start thinking, oh, we need to change the whole system and we need a wholesale change, sometimes just carefully looking at the tasks that are expected of patients and asking carefully whether those tasks are in fact necessary to achieve the goals of patients, and then quitting those that are not. That may be the first line of work for each of our patients.
Let's go to a caller now. We have Jessica with us next in Platteville. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I'm a referral advocate at a rural health clinic in Platteville, and I was wondering if the doctor would be able to comment on the lack of specialty care that's available to patients in rural areas.
All right. Thank you, Jessica. And Dr. Montori, what about accessibility in rural areas?
Very tough problem. Many rural areas are served by critical access hospitals, and we know those have been under attack in terms of their funding. Specialists are expecting different opportunities that maybe those are available in rural areas, and so they tend not to seek employment in those areas. And the resources available in rural areas may not be there to support some specialists because the density or volume of patients is lower. Some technology solutions have become available in the last few years, such as telemedicine, that allow primary care clinicians in rural areas to connect through technology, video conferencing, for instance, with specialty services, and bring those specialists to the point of life of this patient rather than have patients travel long distances to get that kind of care. I think that the technology needs to continue to expand, and those services need to continue to thrive in order to better serve the rural population.
Jessica, thanks a lot. And when we talk about the healthcare system, I mean, in a way, it's not the right term for reform. We're not talking about a monolith here. There are lots of individual providers, and I imagine them each of them do things a little differently. So when you're looking at sort of a many-headed beast like that, how do you begin to reform and have it ultimately be something that's systemic?
Well, so another part of the work of being a patient is, of course, when patients have to see, because of, specialty or access to services, they have to see clinicians that work in different so-called systems that use, for instance, different records. And as a result, those records and the information that is available in one system don't transfer easily to the other. And patients have to do the work of making sure that all their doctors or all their clinicians are on the same page and have access to the same information. And it's often the case that the only one that knows actually what's going on is the patient and none of the clinicians.
clinicians have the full picture. And so that's another piece of the work. You're right, the monster has multiple heads, and change sometimes seems very difficult. I am partial to a kind of change that puts patients and communities in the driver's seat, because they know the kinds of challenges they have to go through in order to get the care that they need and want. And I don't see clinicians, doctors like me, leading the change, and I certainly don't see payers and healthcare organizations creating change on behalf of patients, but more on behalf of their own business objectives. So I'm really hopeful for eventually some major change that's driven by patients, some form of a patient revolution, and I hope that that will come soon.
So what would that be? I'm a patient. What do I do if I want to bring about a revolution?
Well, I think there are certain things one can do. For instance, at the level of the clinic visit, at each visit you go and have with your clinician, participate actively if you can. And if you can, bring a loved one or an advocate with you that can participate actively in that visit. Do you really need all those tests? Do you really need all those treatments? Are there ways of simplifying the tests and treatments? Do I really need to come back in 2 weeks? Do I really need to get those follow-up tests? So question and ensure that the clinician knows what your goals are and that the objectives of the treatment and the treatments are in fact matched. So there's personal advocacy that can occur in every visit. And if the clinician has no time for you to have to ask those questions in this visit, schedule another visit until you get your questions answered and you get the care that you need. Of course, scheduling another visit is more work for you, and that's why we need to fundamentally change that. And then the next level is at the level of the community. If your community has more than one hospital, more than one clinic, work hard so that they won't compete with each other. If they compete, each of them is going to get their own set of services, their own set of CAT scans, their own set of robots that do surgeries, their own set of surgeries, and then they'll have to pay for all of that. And the best way that those hospitals and clinics have to pay for all that technology is to bring more patients through their doors. So you'll have to do more tests and more treatments than perhaps you need so that these hospitals and clinics can stay afloat financially. Make sure that as a community, your healthcare organizations in your community collaborate so that they don't have to overlap services and each one can serve the needs of the community and that they have common information services so that patients don't have to negotiate. Those are a couple of areas and instances in which patients could bring about change at the local level.
We're talking to Dr. Victor Montori from the Mayo Clinic, talking about the work of being a patient. And back to our phones now. Roger in Fitchburg is next. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Well, I have been severely disabled for 45 years. I think the first step in solution to these problems is single-payer health care. Going beyond that, socialized medicine. Many prominent physicians in Wisconsin are for that. I've lost tens of thousands of dollars just because I missed deadlines in applying for co-payments from insurance because of the complexity of the systems. The drugstores don't work with the doctors or...
Roger, thank you for that. And Roger saying he believes part of the solution is single-payer health care. What do you think, Dr. Montori?
I have to agree that simplifying the administrative aspect of healthcare is absolutely part of the solution, because a lot of the work comes from the paperwork and the phone calls and the pre-approvals and other things, and it would be simple to deal with just one entity rather than multiple entities. I personally find quite compelling the notion of a simplified financial payment system, and a single payer is one of those simplified approaches.
And as we wrap up here, are you hopeful? Are you seeing signs that there might be the kind of shift that you're talking about towards something which is easier to navigate?
I have to be hopeful. Going from completely ignoring the issue to now having a radio program where we spend time discussing with folks about how much work it is to be a patient and the potential ways in which we can reduce it, to me, sounds like progress. It's early days. Let's work to try to reduce the work of being a patient. Let's work for a healthcare system that responds to our needs in ways that doesn't take away from us the energy and time that we need to pursue our own hopes and dreams. That's what I would like, and I think we're making progress.
Dr. Montori, thank you so much for joining us today.
Delighted.
That was Dr. Victor Montori, professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic. He's a practicing diabetes doctor, researcher, and author, also a recognized expert in minimally disruptive medicine. Joined us there to talk about the work of being a patient. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.